two magazines that demonstrate the virtues of going deep rather than wide when it comes to subject matter, first with travel and then with flowers. Plus, a look ahead to this year's Stack Awards for independent magazines. That's all ahead today here on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Let's kick off today's programme with a good friend of ours. It's Steve Watson from Stack Magazines. Steve, welcome back to Midori House. Good to have you with us as always. One of the programme's oldest friends, I would say, by which I mean a friend of long standing.
That's fine. I'm also very old. That's fine.
How do we find you? Are you well? How's things?
Yeah, great. Thank you. Great. We're back in full swing now. Summer is officially over.
Yeah.
School went back this week. Yeah, it's all happening.
I like it. It feels like always a dynamic time of the year, and particularly dynamic at other Stack Towers, that which you patrol, of course. You're heading for award season, which is always,
yeah.
Always exciting anyway. What's the run up to that like? Does it consume almost all of your attention?
Oh man, it's a killer. It's an
Why do you do
killer.
These things?
We had Lucy, who is our awards manager, started a couple of weeks ago, and she's brilliant. She's totally on it with managing the entries and everything, but it's still, there's just no way that it doesn't consume everything, because it is the biggest thing in the year for us. Started 2 years ago with just like a thing that I ran myself, because I thought that would be a good idea, and that nearly killed me.
A lot of these things start that
exactly,
way.
Exactly, yeah. Hey, we should find a way of bringing together the best independent publishing that's happened in the last year, and then get a bunch of august judges, yourself included, of course.
Oh, so you do make some exceptions to that augustness rule.
get people to send their magazines in. We shortlist them. We send them out to the judges all around the world. And then we have a big judging day and an awards ceremony in November. And then it's all done again for another year.
Very exciting. And when you travel around, because I think you were at IndieCon recently.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Are people already sort of asking, oh, you know, what's caught your eye this year? People sort of already interested on, you know, what's on the shortlist? No, just out of passing interest. Do you get that sense already? People having those sorts of chats?
I tell you, the really nice thing has been since the start of the year, getting emails from people saying, when do the awards open? So when's it happening? Mm-hmm. And it's so nice that, you know, we don't talk about it until the summer, basically. But it's so nice to know it's on people's minds in that time. The stressful thing now, of course, is we actually need to get the magazines in. So I think that what a lot of people don't understand is that we really judge the magazines. I mean, there are application forms, but they're very short. We need to get the magazines in. And so we actually have this like really restricted amount of time where Lucy is spending all of her time at the moment contacting people saying, come on, get these magazines.
It's a test of those distribution models. That
exactly.
Always so
exactly.
Concerned about.
And it suddenly becomes that. So that, you know, we will spend the next 3 weeks saying to people, come on, get these magazines in. The deadline is 29th of September. And then from the beginning of October, we start the shortlisting. And so then the stress becomes, oh my God, there are so many magazines in here. But it's going to be all worth it in the end.
And remind people, if they want to sort of find out more, maybe make some late submissions, or just find out where to keep watching for, you know, the big day itself, where should they head? To the regular site?
Yeah, so everything is at stackmagazines.com/awards. All of the categories are on there. We've got 10 categories. All of the judges are on there. So you can take a look and see who are the people who I really want to pour over my magazine.
Fantastic. We encourage people to do exactly that. Not, though, until they've listened to the rest of the programme, because we've got, as ever, a stack of magazines in front of you. And I mentioned you were at IndieCon. Let's just do a bit of a sort of health of the nation address, because you've got the Stack Awards. We're sitting here on our Stack programme talking about independent publishing, well, and all publishing. What was the sort of narratives, particularly when you were talking to people in Germany over the last couple of weeks and on your general travels? We know there are still challenges out there from, you know, the cost of paper to this sort of thing, revenue model, sceptical advertisers, whatever it might be. How are you finding things? I mean, I guess you're focusing very much on the great editorial, you know, the great creative messages. But industry-wise, Are we in a good place in whatever we are, Q3 of 2017?
Absolutely. You mentioned the challenges. It has always been thus. The challenges have always been there. And actually, so thinking about IndieCon, the thing that I think they do so well is bring together magazine makers from all over the place. So I met there for the first time a guy called Yan Yeo, who is a publisher of books and magazines in China. And hearing him and also Nelson Ng from Lost magazine, he was there as well, hearing them speak about the publishing scene in China at the moment, I just find so exciting. I actually had Nelson talk about that for the first time last year, and they just had their first independent magazine fair, essentially, like an independent art books fair. And that had been incredibly successful. And then literally like the week before I saw them this year, it happened again, and it was even bigger, and there's even more interest. And so actually then, of course, the question becomes, well, how big can this thing get without the authorities becoming interested in it? Because actually there's this a willing blind eye is turned to these magazines, because of course you're absolutely not allowed to publish your own magazines in China. And so it's finding the ways around that. And so, for example, Yan Yeo was saying with his magazine that he just made, the first one he put out, and I think he said that he did like 10,000 copies, which is, you know, for him, like nothing. For the launch of a new magazine, 10,000 is huge. But then a licensed publisher has picked up on that, and so from the second issue onwards, it is going to be an official magazine that is, you know, it's allowed to be distributed.
So that's super interesting. There's almost a sweet spot of how big you can get before you need to affiliate, and exactly. That's a tightrope, and that's probably a challenge that is a bit different from some of the indie publishers that we speak to week on week,
because
you don't normally have to worry about things like the state's view of what you're doing.
Quite. And the I think the really difficult thing is that because it's all grey areas, they were saying that actually you never get told what's okay. There's no kind of, well, so the line is here, you could go up to there, and then it's a problem. You only hear about it when it's a problem. And by that point, it's too late.
So it's not about where the red line's drawn. It's just there are no lines, and it's all by intuition. Fascinating stuff. Let's have a look at some of the titles that you've got with you this week, Steve. Starting with Brazilian, I think my colleague Fernando mentioned this one to me before, but give us the lowdown.
Yeah, so this is a magazine called Brasilia. Has a very friendly dinosaur on the cover. I came across this one for the first time with the Stack Awards last year. It's a magazine that is made by the Hanover University of Applied Sciences and Arts. So basically they've got what must be a really great publishing course over there, because everything in here is either by the faculty or by the students. And there's just some fantastic stuff. And that I think I'm right in saying that last year it was all in German. This year it has the English as well. And so last year I could look at the pages and say, well, this looks amazing. Wish I could read more. And this year they've
your
really...
Your wish has come true.
Well, exactly. Yeah. They've delivered on it. And it is just a brilliant piece of publishing.
And we perhaps, as you say, it's unsurprising in the sense that there are still these particular... We know it's a very global scene. You've just described that. But there are particular centres of excellence. And you can only imagine how great some of the staff and probably the students, you know, they're the next generation. But it's coming from a real foundry of publishing excellence, isn't
absolutely.
It?
And I think that, you know, you can look at Germany more widely. That, you know, there's no coincidence that IndieCon happens in Hamburg, that Edge happens in Munich every year. That, you know, there is actually, there's some money in Germany from publishing companies that want to nurture this kind of talent and have these kind of conversations happening.
And it's not philanthropic, though. That's because they know that it's all part of the same ecosystem from which they can continue to make money.
Absolutely.
And it's also joined up with big publishing. We know about the newspaper scene in the country and so on. Intriguing. Where next?
Okay, we've got a great big one next. This is Cartography magazine. And as you see from the cover, they have at the bottom your travel guide. Now, this is a magazine that if I were going to go on my holidays again, I would not be taking that one with me. That's literally like half of your baggage allowance in one magazine.
Maybe there should be a separate carry-on limit for printed matter.
I don't think it should be encouraged.
I don't think EasyJet would go for it. But go on, this looks absolutely lavish.
So they've got a really interesting take on travel, which has this very, I guess, impressionistic, these ideas of travel. So the first story in there is traveling the Peruvian Amazon. And so you get these lovely documentary pictures of the people that they find there. You get these still lives, which give more of kind of an abstract sense of life there. You get this very personal writing about it. And then there's a little map, an itinerary showing where they went. And I was reading it for the first time thinking, what is going on with this? Because it's not a travel guide. I mean, you can't, that does not function as a travel guide. And they've put this map in here and they've put this itinerary in here, but that surely isn't the way it's meant to work. And they have a piece about halfway through the mag where they have the cartographer speaking, not in the first person, but speaking directly. He has this thing of dream maps. And so that became kind of my key to the magazine, and I understand this now much more as an art magazine, which just happens to be going to different places and giving these very personal and emotional responses to the places they find.
And both in the photography and in the pieces, I mean, there is definitely a reverie-like quality to some of these, despite the fact that it is, nominally broken down in your day-by-day itinerary.
It
could almost be like dream sequences. Lovely stuff. And love this guy on the back. Big sloth.
So it's a sloth. I didn't know what that animal was. I just knew that he looked very pleased with himself and he'd got the back cover of the magazine.
He's relaxed because he's got the back cover. He knows that's prime territory. That's why he's so pleased. Cartography, that's a beautiful thing indeed. What's number three?
Okay, so this is a magazine called B, or at least I guess it's called B. It is written B-E colon, and it's the magazine of the Built Environment Trust. Now, that's obviously not the type of magazine that we normally get in stack. You know, we get magazines that are kind of made with lots of passion by individuals. But it really struck me because this is a journal of an institution, but the way that they've approached it is just exactly in the way that any of the magazines that we have on stack would approach their subjects. And it really reminded me of a couple of years ago when the British Journal of Photography had an overhaul and redesigned. And this august institution was essentially putting out its own independent magazine, and have done exactly the same here. And there's a lot of really quite techie stuff in there about materials and mining and construction techniques. But the way it's packaged up and presented to me, I've spent hours with that. It's absolutely fascinating stuff.
And I wonder, does it raise the bar? Because a lot of these print titles now, one imagines that they're fairly generously bankrolled by these institutions. Does it sort of raise the bar for the startup indie publishers? Because they've got to still compete. And so many of the sort of tropes of indie publishing that we're used to are, they're not just aped, but they're kind of pushed, they push the envelope because they've got the budget as well. Does that make it a bit more difficult, or does it just mean that the whole standard, you know, the lowest waterline is raised for everybody?
Right, it's a rising tide. I think that it can only be a good thing when, you know, there's so much material being put out there in the world, and I think it can only be a good thing when we see the standards rising like that. And I think that, you know, I can't imagine that the guys on Eyesore magazine, so like an independent magazine of like urbanism, I can't imagine they would see that and say, oh, well, that's it, we may as well not bother. I think they might see that and think, right, okay, they're doing this, let's make our thing even more distinctive and even more us.
Fantastic stuff. So that's B. I think that's B. We'll go with that.
B colon.
Steve, lovely to talk to you as always. Remind us once again, people can find out more about Stack Awards and various other of the enticing services on offer at your website. And presumably, you're always happy for just people to get in touch.
My desk is covered with the results of people getting in touch. Please do go to stackmagazines.com/awards for the awards, or just check out the blog or whatever you'd like to send us.
Steve, it's a delight. We shall, I'm sure, speak to you again before November, but thanks for coming to see us as always.
Cheers, Tom.
Time now to welcome another Stack regular. Liz Schaefer's the editor of the beautiful Lodestars Anthology, a travel magazine that each issue takes an in-depth look at a different country. Liz popped into our Midori House studios to talk about the latest issue covering New Zealand and to look ahead to an upcoming book all about the publication. Here she is in conversation with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Liz, welcome back here to Monaco 24 on the Stack. And I had the pleasure to have another issue. And it's funny because every country that you choose is one that I want to spend holidays on.
It's one that we want to spend our holidays on, so.
And it's fascinating. It's New Zealand. It's you know, a relatively small population. But there's so much interest. It is a fascinating country. Tell us about the process of choosing New Zealand.
I'd always wanted to do New Zealand. I sort of grew up in Australia and it was the next closest place, essentially. So I have many childhood memories of being there. And it was just always stuck in my mind as being this insanely beautiful landscape and this sort of sense of space and freedom and possibility. And so I think it was just a case of getting through enough Lodestar's issues that we could actually finally go to New Zealand and give it the Lodestar's attention.
And I'm glad that besides the beautiful landscapes and amazing photography, as usual on your magazine, you did talk about coffee as well, because the country.
How can you not?
Yes, how can you not? And again, incredibly food coverage. So where exactly have you been in the country?
So the entire issue does do the North and South Island, although while you might think it's a small country with a small population, it's huge and the amount you can cover is immense. So I think we'd need to do 10 volumes to get everything that we wanted to get in. My journeys personally were primarily on the South Island, Fiordland, which I've always loved, Nelson because there is sunshine, and sort of everywhere in between that offered good food, good coffee, and good vistas, really.
I have a question for you because, you know, of course, each issue is a different country. Does the sales of the magazine change of the country, or you have this kind of those Lodestar's fans that will buy no matter which country you choose, or do you see some sort of variation? Because some countries are clearly trickier than others. Wouldn't you say that?
Yeah, I would. I've always thought that we've had two readers. We've had those who buy the magazine because the country we're featuring is on their wish list, and we hope that we offer sort of an insight and provide information and background knowledge that might be useful. And then the other reader is people who like to sit down with beautiful photography, lovely words, and just have the sense of pure escapism. And so we do find that sales have been pretty steady because we appeal to both markets.
Yes, it's funny because I'm a mixture of those readers as well. Some magazines like I buy every week, but some others I really need like a catchy cover or an interesting topic to buy in some ways. I know I didn't say anything about a magazine review, but what in general would make a travel magazine a good magazine, and what things you sort of avoid when you're making a magazine? Almost a tip for someone who wants to have a magazine in the future.
I think the one rule that we have is write about what makes you truly inspired, what makes you feel elated and happy and, you know, aware of the joys of travel, and as tacky as it sounds, the joys of being alive. If you feel passionate about a place, that's the place you should pitch to an editor, and that's the place the editor should realise that you just want to write about and share about because it moved you in some way. And I think if you're honest about what has that power over you and what appeals to you, and you write honestly about it, then hopefully that is evident in the words and in the photographs, and that makes people want to read more.
Absolutely. And if you don't mind, I think we have some very exciting news about the magazine. There will be a book of the best of. That's a fantastic news. Tell us what you can, because I hopefully will have you back to talk about the book. When is it coming out?
It's coming out in December, just in time for Christmas. We're doing it with a Swedish company called New Heroes and Pioneers. And in it, we have a series of chapters dedicated to one pathway we explored in each of the magazines. And it's not the best of, because I love all places I go and all things we write about, but it's those pathways that have really resonated for whatever reason they have. And it was a chance to sort of revisit them with the contributors that we now have, with the knowledge that we now have, because some of them we visited for the first time 3.5 years ago, and you know, we've changed and we've developed. So it was sort of going back and reconnecting and rediscovering.
And in some ways, your magazine, I mean, the design of it, it is quite bookish anyway. So it wouldn't be a step so different as well for what the magazine is in some ways. What about the upcoming issues? What can you reveal us?
We are working our way on France already, because there is no rest for the wicked. And we have just started to commission our India issue, which will be our 10th issue, which I'm incredibly excited about, because like Japan, which was our previous magazine, I've never been there before, so I'm not entirely sure what to expect, but I feel like it's going to be spectacular. And we've also made the decision to revisit England, which was our first issue, and because we were a very small company and we decided to learn a lot on the job, we did a very small print run, which means not many people got to see it. So I think it's, you know, as with the book, going back now with the amazing contributors we have, and that knowledge and that confidence that we didn't have necessarily early on, to redo England and give collectors something that they missed out on. It's very exciting.
And it's always nice talking to you because you're an example of a magazine, you know, that it is a successful story. So I wonder, so is your business model changing or are you keeping what has been working for you? Or are you trying to perhaps expand a little bit? Or tell us, how has it been changing the last year or so?
I was always very focused on growing organically from the beginning. And that is still key to how we're developing and the decisions we make. It has to always be done with the product in mind. We're not going to make sacrifices to make it cheaper so that we can have, you know, cheaper paper so that we can cut our cost. It's always going to be about getting the right people to the right locations and doing it beautifully. But unfortunately, as you do grow, you do start having to make decisions that are more business oriented. So that's probably been the biggest learning curve for me, is being open to how to market, open to new collaborations, and open to unexpected side projects.
Oh, including the book, the upcoming book as well. Tell us about perhaps, you know, there's so many interesting stories on this issue. One that, you know, maybe worked closely. For example, I love, you know, this pictures from the complete angler as well. So
that is fly fishing around New Zealand's South Island.
That's amazing.
There are many stories that I have from my contributors in this book that I got incredibly jealous over that they got to go and write. There's an amazing story on the restaurants of Auckland. And I don't know if New Zealand is known for this. It should be, but it is an amazing, amazing foodie centre. There are people doing really wonderful things with the local produce because they're really proud of it. So you basically, if you go to New Zealand, you won't eat a bad meal. But if you go to Auckland, you'll just never stop eating, basically. I loved Fiordland. It's just such a place of wonder and delight. And, you know, it's on the tourist map, but I still think you have a very personal connection when you get there. And the place I found most interesting was actually a wellness retreat, which is not really me. I'm more a wine and cheese kind of girl. But to be in the location that Aroha, the retreat, was in, which is in Glenorchy on the South Island, and to sort of be waking up at sunrise to do yoga and hiking over mountains and, you know, sitting in hot tubs watching cows on nearby hills,
I want that.
I know, wellness has an appeal suddenly.
Yes, and there's a funny thing, there's a kind of a famous Kiwi, Sam Neill as well.
Sam Neill,
yeah. I like Sam Neill.
I love Sam Neill. I think my favourite film is The Hunt for the Wilder People, and I just sort of fell in love with him again through that. But he actually has a winery that has been around for a while and was part of the sort of the Rhine revival, so we decided to talk to him about that because, of course, New Zealand is known for its wine.
That was Liz Schaefer, editor of Lodestar's anthology and issue 8, All About New Zealand, is out now. Finally on today's programme, a welcome new addition to newsstands. Future Fossil Flora is a magazine that explores the relationship between humans and flowers, with each issue exploring just one flower, again, in depth. The first is dedicated to that most symbolically and chemically loaded of all flowers, the poppy. Here's editor-in-chief Kaylee Ross talking to Fernando.
Kaylee, a pleasure to welcome here at Midori House. And
thank you so much for having me.
It gives me much more pleasure, even because we met at Modern Magazine conference, I believe it was last year, more than a year ago.
Yeah.
And you were mentioning that you wanted to do this magazine, and, you know, you're telling me some of your ideas, and here it is.
Yeah,
I have a beautiful, the first issue of Future Fossil Flora. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic. Tell us about the concept of the magazine for those who didn't have a chance to see it yet.
Yeah, definitely. So Future Fossil Flora is a modern botanical study. So it's really a combination of my love for modern art, my passion for flowers. You know, flowers have always had such an impact on my life. I have really wonderful childhood memories associated with particular types of flowers, and I just love reading about the culture of them. But I kind of found it was a struggle to actually find material to read that was about kind of culture and the history of flowers. So many material out there, you know, it's a lot of gardening, which is wonderful, but, you know, I was interested in something different. So I was really excited to bring together, you know, different stories, fiction, poems, a really vision of what flowers look like in modern times.
And for your first flower is one that, you know, that has a lot of history, even some Definitely. Historical connotations as well, which is the poppy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
How special is that this flower in your life?
Yeah, it's been really, really interesting exploring, you know, her history, her culture. That was one of the reasons why I wanted to kind of choose it as our debut flower to feature in the magazine, because there is so much material. And the more research I did, the more I really got into it. And it was quite a lot to bite off. So I think we have some really, really varied stories, different perspectives from contributors that are based all around the world on how this one flower has inspired them and, you know, the different influence it's had in different countries. Yeah.
Tell us a bit more the process of making this magazine. So I believe you started with Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
But tell us, you know, do you have any visions, perhaps subscription or any other types of advertising? Tell us how's it going?
Yeah, it's going well. It has definitely been a journey. I don't have any prior design or publishing experience. I come from a photography background, so that's what I studied at college in Canada. So yeah, it was just all self-taught, basically. Lots of networking, lots of connecting with people like yourself, and at these wonderful events that are all around London, like the printout events that Steve Watson and Jeremy Leslie do. Every time I could, get face to face with them, ask them a question, or the people that they have speaking at these events, I would always go prepared with one question, depending on what the topic of the event was on. And Angharad Lewis's book, So You Want to Publish a Magazine. I think we had a conversation about that before.
Yeah, she came in the stack a few months ago.
Yeah, her book is amazing. It's just so easy, step by step. So that's really what I did, is just take it step by step, one step at a time, basically. The thing from creating a website, getting the social media, doing the Kickstarter, getting some funding. I did that after I had already curated the whole issue. So I reached out to contributors, got enough material together. And then when we got the funds, I designed it. And we just, went to print about 6 weeks ago.
And tell us about the interest in the magazine. Did you get a lot of backers, perhaps even internationally, or mainly focused here in the UK?
We did get a lot of international interest. Most of it was like people who I do know personally. So I really hope that it does connect with people around the world, because that's one of the main purposes of this magazine, is to really bring together different voices, different perspectives, finding a mutual connection through flowers. That's mm-hmm. one of the main purposes, of why I wanted to bring this into the world, basically. Just people finding that mutual connection through that medium that has brought people together for so long.
And you are filling a gap, because I did notice, especially the young generation, that there's more interest in flowers. Mm-hmm. And you're right, all you can see is in the gardening articles and newspapers, which again, very interesting, but yeah, I think this is a completely different focus when you talk to about flowers. What about, what's next? For example, if someone is interested in Future Fossil Flora, where should they go? Or who are your stockists? Or can you buy it online?
Definitely. So we're currently stocked in Mag Culture, and you can definitely buy it online. So it's futurefossilflora.com. And you can follow us on Instagram, so at Future Fossil Flora. I'm really excited about, getting some more content up online, little excerpts from the magazine. But the majority of it obviously will be in the printed publication. And yeah, I'm really excited about distributing internationally as well. So that's definitely a next step for us.
Are you, maybe it's too early to ask, but are you already thinking about issue 2? Or?
Oh, definitely. Yep, we're going to feature the orchid. So I'm starting to curate
it's
that.
There. I was going to ask, will you mention what's going to be the flower?
Yeah.
And when do you think this will come out?
Probably spring of 2018.
That was Kaylee Ross, Editor-in-Chief of Future Fossil Flora, which you can buy at futurefossilflora.com. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our producers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. If you have any comments or queries, then write to Fernando. He's on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks very much for tuning in.